discovered, oh, I think it was around 1903. Yes, 1903. By the British physicist Poynting. It's a most interesting effect. It says this. If you have a particle that's traveling either in a circular or elliptical orbit or any kind of orbit about the sun, there are certain things that can happen to it due to sunlight hitting it, due to radiation hitting that particle. Now, by the way, all objects in the solar system travel in elliptical orbits, which means that they have their origin in the solar system itself. There are no objects traveling on open orbits, at least as they approach the sun. They're not traveling on open orbits. At least the astronomers never discovered any object traveling in open orbits. By that I mean parabolic orbits or hyperbolic orbits. Those are open orbits. Now, sometimes an object may go away from the vicinity of the sun in an open orbit, which means if it does, it, of course, is shot out of the solar system and never returns to the solar system. But there's never been, at least no astronomer has ever reported, an object approaching the sun on an open orbit, a parabolic orbit, or a hyperbolic orbit. All the orbits are closed orbits. Elliptical, there can be circular orbits, but nobody has ever observed a circular orbit. Our orbit is nearly circular, isn't it? But it has a very, very small eccentricity, very close to being circular, but there don't seem to be any perfectly circular orbits. I don't know. You know, there's always seemed like a philosophical bent to say that circles represent perfection and ellipses do not. I don't know how mathematical curves have anything to do particularly with perfection and imperfection, but there's some people that think a circle is perfect and ellipse is not perfect. How do you decide whether a curve whether a curve has anything to do with morality? Curves like that, mathematical curves, whether they have anything to do with morality or not. But there's some people that seem to think that mathematically some things are perfect, some things are imperfect, and an ellipse represents some state of imperfection. I don't know where in the world that comes from, but maybe there is such an argument that's convincing that mathematical figures have something to do with morality, have something to do with sin or the lack of sin or something or the other. But I don't know what it is particularly. I never did know that there was really any difference except in shape between a circle and an ellipse. I don't know how one has to do with morality, perfection, the other one imperfection, but some people seem to think so. Well, anyhow, there don't seem to be any perfect circles. Nothing seems to be moving in a perfect circle in the solar system, but in elliptically shaped orbits. Now, an ellipse, you know, if you take a football and you were to slice it down the long axis, you know, and the thing stayed out, stayed extended, the curve that you could draw around the edges of that football along that long dimension would be the shape of an ellipse, roughly. Or if you take a basketball that has been compressed along one axis slightly, and you could cut the thing open, the cross section would be something that's roughly like an ellipse. This is what I mean by an ellipse. All objects travel in elliptical orbits that we know about, at least in the solar system. And so far as stars are concerned, all stars that we know about travel in elliptical orbits. Nothing seems to travel in a circle, and nothing seems to be traveling in an open orbit. Now, all these dust particles, and I've been talking about these things quite a bit, and comets, all of these objects are traveling in elliptical orbits. They come from inside the solar system. If these objects originated outside the solar system, comets, for instance, came from the galaxy and were not local to the solar system, they'd have to come in on open orbits, come in on orbits that were either parabolas or hyperbolas. So all these objects are local to the solar system. Maybe somebody has suggested, I usually refer to this and forgot about it yesterday, somebody might have said, well, comets are coming from outside the solar system into the solar system and replenishing the supply. If they were, they would not be traveling on closed orbits about the sun, travel on open orbits about the sun. And there are no such things, no open orbits, at least that we know about. Well, back to the Poynting-Robertson effect. Suppose you got a particle traveling either in a circular orbit, if you like, or in an elliptical orbit. If radiation hits that particle, there are a number of things that can happen to it. If the particle is less than about a micron in diameter, now a micron is a 10,000th of a centimeter. If the particle is smaller than that, it can even be less than a 100,000th of a centimeter, but let's say a 10,000th. If a particle is less than that in size, which is very, very small, microscopic, radiation pressure is greater than the gravitational pull. The force due to the radiation pressure is greater than the gravitational pull on that particle. And the radiation pressure will cause the particle to be pushed right out of the solar system. What I want to mention first are a number of ways to get rid of dust in the solar system. You see, what I'm aiming at is this. If we still got a lot of dust around, and I have some idea as to how long it would take to get it out due to the various effects, and we still have it around, then I have an upper limit on the length of time this dust can be around, and perhaps I have then an upper limit on the age of the solar system. This is what I'm aiming at in discussing this ways to get rid of dust in the solar system. Now, if particles are less than, a 10,000th of a centimeter, some say a 10,000th, really you can move that number down a little bit, but anyhow, less than a 10,000th of a centimeter in diameter, the radiation pressure, the force due to the sunlight on that particle, is larger than the gravitational force and will push the particle right out of the solar system itself, will blow it out of the solar system, so to speak. Now, if the particle is larger than that, say from a micron, a 10,000th of a centimeter, on to larger radii or diameters, then another effect is a predominant effect and comes to play. All of the effects operating in the solar system that we know about tend to cleanse or sweep the solar system clean of loose material in between the planets. And as a matter of fact, these effects are exerted on planets, but they're such massive objects that there's not much of an effect produced on them. The effect that is produced by light on particles larger than a 10,000th of a centimeter in diameter is called the Poynting-Robertson effect, and here's how it works. Suppose you have a little particle zipping along whichever way you want it to go. Goes counterclockwise around the sun. I was trying to remember which way to draw there to indicate that. Well, going counterclockwise around the sun, radiation from the sun comes in, hits the little particle, and the particle, if it is small, ordinarily absorbs the radiation very quickly. And Einstein says that when something absorbs radiation, there can be a conversion of matter into energy, or rather energy into matter. And what happens to that little particle then when it absorbs the radiation? Its mass increases. I wasn't going to explain that this way this morning, but I'll go ahead. I'll explain it two ways. Well, the mass of it increases. Well, now, that particle possesses what is called a quantity of motion as it moves in its orbit. Now, you don't need to take all this down unless you just want to. The particle has a quantity of motion. The quantity of motion that a particle possesses is the product of its mass and its velocity. Velocity or speed. They're not the same thing, but we'll use them as if they were. All right, if you multiply the mass of the object times its speed, that tells you how much motion it possesses. An object with a large mass can be moving with a small velocity and have a lot of momentum. An object with a small mass but a large velocity can have a large momentum. A freighter sitting in the harbor, barely moving, has a lot of momentum because it has what? A lot of mass. Momentum, the quantity of motion that a body possesses, is called momentum. But a bullet, faster than a speeding bullet, a bullet speeding along with a very small mass, but with a large velocity, can have a very large momentum too, or quantity of motion. Momentum of an object depends on its mass and its velocity, and as a matter of fact, is equal to the product of those two quantities. Now, if our little particle zipping along here in this orbit, I tell you what, let's put it in a circular orbit for purposes of explanation. The explanation is the same if you put it in an elliptical one, it doesn't make any difference. The radiation from the sun is coming out so that if you drew a tangent to the circle in which the particle is moving, that radiation would be essentially perpendicular to it. Well, that means then, what that really means in the long run, skipping some of the story, means the momentum of that little chunk of matter has got to stay the same. The momentum that it had when the radiation hits it has got to be the momentum that it had before the radiation hit it, or before the sunlight hit it. Well, when the radiation hits the particle, its mass increases. Well, if its mass increases, its momentum can't stay the same, can it? Because the mass has gotten larger, it's got more motion. But there's a law called the conservation of momentum in physics that says that momentum's got to stay the same. Well, what happens is then the particle's velocity drops off. So you've got to keep the product of the mass times the velocity the same or constant. So when the mass increases a little bit, the velocity's got to drop off or decrease. But that little particle is so small that it will practically re-radiate that energy nearly in the twinkling of an eye. Well, the velocity has dropped off and the momentum has decreased, but what? The mass now. Once that energy is radiated, the mass has gone back to its original value because it's given up that energy that it absorbed, but its momentum is cut down, its velocity is cut down, and so what will the little particle do then? It's traveling slower than it was before the radiation hit it, so it has got to move in due to the gravitational pull of the sun, has got to move in a little bit closer to the sun. Because the gravitational pull is still the same on that particle. And the sun pulls it in a little bit closer. It slows down in its orbit. When it slows down, it gets in a little closer to the sun. That's called the Poynting-Robertson effect. Let me explain it a different way. If you got a little particle move, there are different ways you can explain this thing. Depends on the way you want to look at it. If you got a little particle that's zipping along in space, and again, if it's hit by radiation, it will absorb that radiation. Since it is so small, it will absorb it rather readily and then re-radiate it. Now, when it re-radiates that, and you look at the particle from outside the particle, and certainly the observer is not on the particle itself, but you're looking at the particle from outside it, when that particle, moving along, radiating energy in front, radiating energy in back, because it radiates energy in all directions. The particle is moving in that direction, so in front of the particle, the energy sort of bunches up, doesn't it? As it radiates that energy out, it's moving in that direction, so there's a tendency for the energy to bunch up in front of the particle. But the energy that's being radiated behind, since the particle's moving that way, the particle is running away from this energy, so to speak, and the energy back here gets thinned out. So in front of the particle, you're getting a bunching up of the radiation, and in behind it, you're getting a thinning out, just like a boat doing what? Moving through the water. In front of the boat, it heaps up the water and it accumulates because it's moving in that direction. The water tends to what? Thin out because the boat is running away from that water. Well, this is the same thing that essentially is happening to our particle. And what this means then, if you have more energy on one side than the other side, you've got the same energy on the sides. If you've got more energy in front of the particle than behind the particle, this means there will be a force opposing the motion of the particle, tending to slow it down. There will be a force tangent to its path, a tangential force, a resistive force, that will work against the motion of our particle. And what it'll do, it will slow down. Its velocity will decrease. When its velocity decreases, it moves in closer to the sun. Now, this is happening, though, all the time, isn't it? Because the sunlight is shining the whole time. So this is happening continually. So a particle then does what? Moves in closer and closer to the sun as it moves along. Every inch that it moves is slightly closer to the sun than it was before. And finally, then, what will the particle do then? Get in so close to the sun that it'll be burned up due to the heat of the sun. Or if it's able to, it's got an asbestos quality about it, and it's able to get in closer, finally it'll just hit the sun itself. Probably nothing ever hits the sun, burned up long before it gets to the sun. But this spiraling effect, you see, of a particle moving in closer and closer to the sun is called the Poynting-Robertson effect. Yes? Well, so much energy hitting it that it'll just vaporize the chunk of rock. Well, it's there in the form of atoms, then, yes. All the atoms are there. But by that, what I mean is you get a chunk of rock, gets in close to the sun, you won't see the chunk of rock anymore because it'll vaporize. You'll have atoms running loose out there instead of rocks or pieces of rock. All right, then, this is referred to as the Poynting-Robertson effect. First discovered by Poynting, he made an error in the effect, the magnitude of the effect, and Larmor pointed it out, and then somebody said Larmor was wrong and claimed that relativity said there would not be such an effect as this. And Robertson, in it seemed like the 1930s, came along, redid the whole problem from the aspect of relativity and quantum mechanics and did get the effect, except larger than Poynting had gotten. And today it is established that such as this actually happens. Now, you see, what I'm getting at is this. If, then, we consider this dust in space we can set up equations and work out how long it'll take for all this dust to spiral in to the sun. And if the solar system is billions of years old, then if it should come out that the length of time... This indicates that something I say is wrong with the age of the solar system, or else you must have something to replenish the supply of that dust to make up for it spiraling in. So, let me give you a very simple formula. I'm not interested in doing any mathematics here. It's needless, but I want to make a calculation or two for you. You don't have to do this on the test or anything like that, of course. I've already told you that. This is for my benefit, since I'm bad to not remember numbers. Let me give you a formula here that gives you the length of time that it takes for dust particles to spiral into the sun if they're traveling in circular orbits. Now, if they're traveling in elliptical orbits, the time is much quicker. I use the formula for circular orbits because it is so very, very simple. The formula is much more complicated for elliptical orbits, but the time is much shorter to spiral into the sun if an object is traveling in an elliptical orbit than if it's traveling in a circular orbit. By the way, the Poynting-Robertson effect would make all circular orbits become elliptical orbits if there were any. But this formula is so simple, and it's for a circular orbit, that I'm going to use it. But remember, the times are much smaller if it's an elliptical orbit. Here's the formula. 7 times 10 to the 6th, that's 10 to the 6th means a 7 followed by 6 zeros, 7 million in other words, times the density of the particle, times the radius of the particle in centimeters, times the distance of the particle in astronomical units squared. That's the formula, very simple thing. Nothing to it, hardly. This tells you that, whoops, threw that square right there. All right, this tells you the length of time that it would, if an object is traveling in a circular orbit, and it started at a distance d from the sun, it would only take that length of time in years, this answer is in years, for it to spiral in there. Well, let me give you a range of sizes considered to be the range for dust particles in the solar system, considered to be the range of sizes for what is called the interplanetary medium. Now, there are many, many particles much smaller than this. This is the range for dust particles. The range of sizes is from 10 to the minus 4, by the way, that's a 10,000th centimeter, this size, this many centimeters in radius, and the upper limit for what is ordinarily called dust particles is 10 to the minus 2 centimeters, and that's 1/100th. Of a centimeter. That's considered to be about the range of sizes when you refer to the material as dust material. This is considered to be the range of sizes existing in the solar system. At least this is what the satellite data seems to indicate as to the range of sizes. Now, assuming that the particles are traveling in circular orbits, let me make a calculation on how long it'd take to clean out all the dust. Let's first calculate how long it'd take to clean out all the dust from the distance of the Earth in. All right? Then let's consider how much it'd take to clean out all the dust in the whole solar system, out to 40 astronomical units, which is considered to be effectively the boundary of the solar system, though there's Pluto zipping around. Pluto's considered to be, though, just a runaway moon and not constituting a planet, an original planet or primeval planet, but was a moon that escaped from Neptune due to Triton, a moon of Neptune, and Pluto getting too close to each other in their orbits, and Pluto getting shot out away from Neptune. So we'll take Neptune then as sort of representing the Neptune's orbit, representing the boundary of the solar system. All right, I'll do the calculation. Don't worry about it. If I make an error, some of you catch it, you can point that out. Well, 7 million multiplied times the density. You can take the density to have different values if you like. Most people use 1 gram per cubic centimeter as the density of this material. Some take it as high as about 4.3 grams per cubic centimeter. Take it however you like it. I think I'll take 1 because it makes the multiplication easier. And if you don't like the 1 and you want to use 4.3 grams per cubic centimeter, multiply whatever the answer I get by 4. That'll give it to you then. All right, times the radius of the particle. Let's take it for the very small particles. That's 10 to the minus 2. And let's take it out at the distance of the Earth, as I said first. So that's one astronomical unit squared. So that's one. So the length of time in years, then, to take all of the dust having this size from a distance where the Earth is into the Sun, if it were traveling in a circular orbit, which it is not, but if it were traveling in a circular orbit, would be 10 to the minus 2 times the 7 times 10 to the 6th would be what then? I took the upper one. I'm sorry. I want to take the lower one. Let's take it first. 10 to the minus 4. 10 to the minus 4 times 10 to the 6th is 10 squared. So 700 years would get all of your dust in then from the Earth to the Sun. Now, if you want to take the density as 4 grams per cubic centimeter, say 4.3, then it would be about what? 3,000 years. I'll put that over here. If you want to use the density, instead of the density as 1 gram per cubic centimeter, as I have, you want to use 4.3 grams per cubic centimeter, then the length of time would be about 3,000 years instead of 700 years. I'd clean out everything that size and less. By the way, if you want to talk about particles smaller, well, the radiation pressure is going to get rid of those anyway. But Poynting Robertson effect will sweep everything in 700 years this size from the Earth, distance of the Earth in. Let's go to the edge of the solar system, 40 astronomical units. Well, that's the same answer here, except instead of in the d squared here, instead of 1 squared, it would be what? 40 squared, which puts in a 1600 into this thing. And I'll put that on here. I'll just put it on. 1600, multiply that by 1600, and that gives you 2 more zeros there. That'd be 4 zeros, 0, 0, 0, 0. And that'd be 42. You may not be able to see that. Well, I'll just write it here roughly. About 1 million years. Hope that was 1 million as I erased there. In about 1 million years, you would sweep everything from the edge of the solar system into the Sun of that size. Now then, this is a factor of 10 squared larger. So in 100 million years, in only 100 million years, you'd sweep everything in of this size. So what this means is then, now this is from out at the edge of the solar system. You sweep everything in of this size. That means all of the dust then in the solar system would be swept in what? 100 million years. From the edge of the solar system right on in to where the Sun is, you'd have everything swept up, all the dust, at least in 100 million years. That's the upper limit on it. You may have it swept in a lot quicker than that, but that's an upper limit on how long things could go. You say, well, maybe the comets then supply dust. All right, I've already talked about those comets. Well, short-period comets are not even going to last anywhere like that. They're gone in several thousand years, so they can't keep supplying this. And we're taking all the dust from clear out to Neptune in. That sweeps the whole solar system. Now, if you want to go with, say, 4.3 grams per cubic centimeter, then that just says what? Within 400 million years. Now, what I'm getting at is this. The Poynting Robertson effect, then, says that you can't have what? Your solar system should be as clean as a whistle, so to speak, long before you got through the age of the solar, supposed age of the solar system. Yet, is there dust in the solar system? Well, there's that huge zodiacal cloud existing between here and the Sun that reflects tremendous amounts of light, that possesses literally hundreds of billions of tons of this dust material. There is this influx rate that I've been talking about of 14,300,000 tons per year on the Earth itself that's coming from interplanetary space. There are the comets, which supply dust, certainly, but they're being broken up so rapidly they can't be around to keep supplying it. And as a matter of fact, you could exhaust, if you want to say you're getting your material from the asteroid belt, though it doesn't seem how one could get anything much from that. But if you got it from the asteroid belt, you'd exhaust your asteroid belt. in just a little while on this process. So what I, now I agree that the Poynting-Robertson effect doesn't give you an age for the solar system, because we don't know just what the dust distribution is for sure in it. But taking the range that the astronomer, who is uniformitarian in his viewpoint, 99 and 44 one-hundredths percent of them, if not more, certainly of that viewpoint, this is what they say is the range of dust material, what you call interplanetary dust, in the solar system. And I've taken it from the edge in, or from the Earth in. Nobody really believes that you get much dust coming close enough to the sun, more than about an astronomical unit, of any of these sizes. For instance, it's believed that particles smaller than this are the only things existing from the Earth into the sun. Well, I say that the Poynting-Robertson effect then indicates that things are quite young, because the Earth, certainly, and Mars, at least the probes have indicated there are huge clouds of dust around those objects. And there's a lot of dust in space. What I'm saying is, how can the solar system be old and yet have these tremendous quantities of dust material existing? You don't even get, what, a billion years, let alone 4.5 billion years. The closest you would come to a billion years would be if you use this density, which would say this would be 430 million years, which is not even 0.5 billion years still. But everything should be cleaned out by that time, and still you have tremendous quantities of this dust material. What about around stars? Would you have a Poynting-Robertson effect around stars other than the sun? You'd have this Poynting-Robertson effect around any star. And if the star is putting out more energy than the sun, the Poynting-Robertson effect will be pepped up considerably. As a matter of fact, material will be pulled in faster into stars if it takes, say, some time T for material to be pulled into the sun on this effect. If you take some other star, and this star, let's say, is putting out more energy than the sun is per second, the time in that case will be quicker by this factor. For instance, if you take an O star or a B star that radiate ordinarily about 100,000 times more energy per second than the sun does, around those stars you'll get that material pulled in 100,000 times faster than you will about the sun. Now, what does that mean then? That means if there's any dust around these stars, they cannot be old, because the dust would have what? If those are the times in the case of the sun, my goodness, in the case of a star that's putting out 100,000 times more energy, the time is what? 100,000 times quicker. So multiply any of these numbers by 1 over 100,000, and you've got the length of time it would take to what? Pull in one of those particles in the vicinity of one of those O and B stars. For instance, right here is 700 years. Multiply that by 1 over 100,000. And that says in about what? About a thousandth of a year you'll get your particle pulled in then, if it starts at such and such distance and has these other numbers here the same. Or if it's a million years, it means it's out 40 astronomical units from the star. Multiply this by 1/100,000th. And it says you get all the dust in what? 1,000 years in that case around that star. With the more energy the object puts out, the faster this Poynting-Robertson effect acts. Now, are there the huge dust clouds around O and B stars? Well, there sure are. They're the stars that they say are forming out in these huge dust clouds. And here you have tremendous clouds of dust around these, surrounding some of these stars. The Poynting-Robertson effect says what? Why, there should be empty space with no gas or dust particles around stars like that, because it would, so to speak, suck them in so fast. Much faster. Well, Robertson pointed out that this has very serious problems for the cosmologist, because within, as to use his phrase, in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, he said, in recent times, you would clean out the dust in your solar system. And he pointed, said, then the cosmologist has a serious problem here of explaining the presence of dust in the solar system. Well, that's appointing Robertson effect. That's another in this set of effects that I think indicate that the solar system is young. Yes.
Is there
Well, some might say this would be an argument for it, but I don't think they would maintain that there is material forming in the solar system. They'd put it out between the stars, or at least that's what Hall argues. Yes, Fred Hall argues that matter, or he used to argue, I don't know what he's arguing now for sure. He used to argue that, the reason I say that, he took it all back once upon a time and said, well, he's wrong about the steady state idea, dropped it, but he had a press conference recently in which he's proposing all over again a modified version of the steady state. You see, Hall proposed the steady state idea because it's believed that the universe is expanding. And if it is expanding, and he believes, you see, when you say steady state, that means all of the properties of the universe are the same in space and in time. For instance, if you took a look out in the edge of our galaxy, to say that things are in a steady state means if you look at that position, you've got always the same general physical properties so far as the distribution of matter and temperature is concerned. Hoyle would also say that not only do you have the steady state in space in position, but he would say that you have a steady state in time also, which means if you went back with Alley-Oop into the past and took a look, and if you believed you could go back millions or billions of years and take a look at things, he would say a million years ago, if you're standing somewhere in the galaxy or between galaxies or somewhere in the universe and took a look at a particular position, you'd see the same thing then that you would see right there today, or you would see a million years into the future. This is called the cosmological principle. If things stay the same in space, that's referred to as the cosmological principle. If it stays the same not only in position in space, but in time, with time in space, then that's called the perfect cosmological principle. Hoyle is saying that everything is in a steady state, both time-wise and position-wise. He would say, go anywhere in the universe, and what you see there, if you don't look on too small a scale, is what you'd see in some other place in the universe. All points in space, he would say, have the same physical properties. But we know that's not true, of course. Any astronomer knows that, because the distributions of the galaxies are very different. Distribution of stars within our own galaxy is radically different. Everything is different in this universe, it seems. But Hall went right on and assumed it anyhow. Hall does everything with a straight face. He violates all the laws of physics and does so without the slightest hesitancy. And he admits it. He doesn't make any bones about it. It's good he admits it. He said that to get an expansion of the universe in the first place, he said what happens is that when particles get close enough to each other, instead of gravitational forces acting, which are attractive forces, he says the gravitational force, which is an attractive force, becomes still a gravitational force, but becomes a repulsive force when two particles get close enough to each other. They start pushing each other apart. Well, of course, if that is the case, you wonder how you get generation of energy in these stars by the proton-proton cycle, where the force to begin with is a repulsive force due to both particles possessing positive electrical charge. But you see, nobody in the laboratory or anywhere has ever observed that an attractive force becomes a repulsive force. But Hall says, I don't care. Make any difference whether you've seen it or not. This is what happens. Then he would say, matter is continually being created because he's already assumed what? Steady state. And if the universe is expanding, that means matter is spreading apart. And if matter is spreading apart, then you can't have the same physical properties at all the points in space and at all times. So he says, steady state's got to exist. Therefore, matter must continually be what? Created. Or come into existence to fill in the void that's being created as the universe expands. So he says the matter must continually come into existence, or continuous creation, as it's sometimes called. And that's a violation of the conservation of matter and energy law. And since he says there is no beginning, really, to the universe and no end, he has a violation of the second law of thermodynamics, or the law of entropy, which says the universe is a universe that is dying. and that there had to be a beginning to it, since it cannot exist for an infinity, in an infinity of time, in a dying state, and not die. It has to die sometime or other. And so he has a violation of another law. Well, Paul, it doesn't make any difference to him. He rather enjoys things like that. Paul writes some science fiction himself, you know. Not in addition to his steady state theory, he writes science fiction on the side. And he likes to write detective mysteries, too, which is all right. Nothing wrong with that, but I wish he could separate in his thinking what is science fiction and what is not. Now, Dr. Moore has given you lectures on proper scientific procedure and so forth. There is a distinction between speculative ideas and scientific hypotheses and an approach to this problem. Now, I have been criticized strongly, seem like everywhere I go, by criticizing Hall. People say, oh, you must be imaginative. Well, I agree you must be to be a good scientist, because this pure logic business, pure intellect, is not a quality of the best of scientists. You want to remember that. Scientists work by hunches. It's those fellows that really get a good hunch occasionally that come up with something. You don't find out about sea monsters by analyzing seaweed over and over and over. It's the people who can use their imagination and think who are really the great scientists, as a matter of fact. But when you propose an idea, a purely speculative idea in the name of science, and you propose it rather dogmatically, that's a different matter, you understand. An entirely different matter. It is an attempt to impress your philosophical bias on science itself. And as Herbert Dingell remarked, I think it was in 1954, in his presidential address to the Royal Astronomical Society, he claimed that Hall and his followers were attempting to impress their philosophical position on astronomy itself. Because, as he so well pointed out, the cosmological principle in the first place does not seem to be true. The universe seems to be very different at different positions in space. And in the second place, how in the world do you prove the perfect cosmological principle that everything has been the same in time as well as space? Suppose you grant the space idea, which nobody does. Everybody considers it purely an assumption and a speculative position. But anyhow, suppose you grant that. How do you prove the perfect cosmological principle that says everything has been the same in time, not only in space, but anywhere you look in the universe, you've got the same properties? And further, the perfect cosmological principle, not only anywhere you look in space, you have the same properties, but any time you look at anywhere you look, you've got what? The same properties. It's like saying what? You never really change with time. Well, Dingell was right. This is purely a philosophical principle and may not have anything to do with reality at all. And to call this science is to try to force your philosophy on things. He criticized Hall and company severely on this question. He's exactly right. Well, I believe certainly you have to come up with spectacular ideas to explain things. But before you have the proof of those spectacular ideas as being a true explanation, you should present it for what it really is, namely a speculative idea regarding something, and not a scientific explanation for something. Because there's so many people that do what? Believe these things so readily, as if they were true and not speculation. Well, let's go to something else that shows that things are quite young. Let me tell you about the work of a colleague of mine down at the University of Texas, El Paso, Professor Tom Barnes. His monograph, by the way, that he wrote for the Creation Research Society, or rather for the Institute, is back here now, and you can get a copy of it. Certainly worth your $2.50, whatever they're charging for it. Professor Barnes has done a work that I believe is truly revolutionary in regard to this age of the Earth, and I'd like to tell you about it in the remaining time that I have. Some years ago, well, in 1835, that is some years ago, a fellow by the name of Gauss, a very famous mathematician, measured the strength of the Earth's magnetic field. Now, the Earth has a magnetic field. By magnetic field, what I mean is that in a region of space around the Earth and on the surface of the Earth and within the Earth, if you should bring a little compass needle into that region of space, or if you brought a conductor, say a piece of wire that had a current traveling in it, you'd find that there was a force exerted on the compass needle and a force or a force exerted on this conductor that had a current in it. These forces exerted on current-bearing conductors or on compass needles, pieces of magnetite as they originally were, are called magnetic forces. And when your compass needle will spin and react, you use this as your test or indication that you're in the presence of a magnetic field, what's called a magnetic field, or you're in the presence of something that is exerting magnetic forces. Now, a rose is a rose, of course, and that word, the word magnet, magnetic field, and so forth, are just terms used to describe a particular effect. Nobody knows really what ultimately causes their speculation, what causes a magnet, causes something to be magnetic, or really what a field is. But anyhow, these are just descriptive terms. The physicist never, by the way, really defines anything. He just describes things. He's not quite as bad as the biologist along that line. Bit better only than that, I'd say. Biologists have protoplasm or something or the other involved in everything and never really get around to saying what protoplasm really is. Physicists are about as bad, though. They describe everything. Nobody ever says what energy is. It's just a description of energy. What is energy? What is space? What is time? Well, time's a bit easier to define than space and energy. If you define it in terms of the way man measures it, at least, and that's all the physicist can do. Well, anyhow, the Earth has a magnetic field, and this magnetic field is produced by whatever the mechanism is, similar, though, or analogous, to that magnetic field produced by a huge bar magnet embedded within the Earth, inclined at about 11 degrees to the axis of rotation of the Earth, and the center of the magnet's offset about 300 kilometers from the center of the Earth. Now, nobody's claiming there's any big bar magnet inside the Earth, you understand. What I'm saying, what Professor Barnes is saying, what any geophysicist would say, is the Earth acts like it has a huge bar magnet embedded within it. Well, this magnetic field is quite strong today, even for a planet. Most planets don't have magnetic fields. The Earth does, and its field is very strong, though. The field today, even, is a bit stronger than that in some stars, but and a very strong field even today. Now, Gauss in 1835 made a measurement of the strength of this field, and he built a thing called a magnetometer for doing that. After 1835, people measured the field continually. Every year, a bunch of measurements were taken. And in the 1880s, and I've forgotten the date, and I better not say, since you can read it in Professor Barnes' monograph, seems like it's in the 1880s somewhere, Horace Lamb, a British physicist of quite a high reputation, decided to look into the change in that magnetic field. He noticed, when he looked at the data, from about 1835 down into the 1880s, he noticed that the magnetic field was getting weaker, was decreasing in strength, getting weaker and weaker. And he was interested then, suppose we project into the past this change. Well, you say, all right, here you catastrophists are doing what the uniformitarians do. I'm just telling you what Lamb did. This is what he did. I didn't say I was doing that, but I would, because you can use this procedure to check a hypothesis or a model that has been proposed to see if it is inconsistent. That's a standard procedure, and there's nothing wrong with that scientifically. You can accuse us of being like the uniformitarians if you want to, suit yourself. But that's a standard procedure to test any model. The evolutionist would test the catastrophist model in exactly the same fashion. Take what the catastrophist says and see if it has any inconsistencies in it by our own assumptions and procedures. Well,
Lamb said, let's work back into the past and find the strength of the magnetic field in the past. Now, all geophysicists and astronomers believe that a planet can just hold a certain size field. There's an upper limit to how strong the field can be, and the planets still hold this field. You reach a situation that at least is believed to be physically impossible, that the planet can't hold a stronger field. So Lamb calculated back until he got a field that he figured was as strong as the planet could hold. And he said, this then is the length of time that I have to go back to get this sized field will be the age of the Earth then, because the planet won't be able to hold a field stronger than that. If you go back any further in time, you'll get too strong a field that he considered physically impossible for the planet to have. So on that basis, he said the age of the Earth is 300,000 years. He said you go back any further in time than that, you get far too strong a magnetic field. And he said the age of the Earth is only 300,000 years. Well, this came... Hey, this thing slipped down, hasn't it? Oh, well. On the other end. Hang on just a minute. Technical difficulties. Don't have any music to play. Well, I'm getting hooked up again. All right. Back on the air. Well, the people recording this. Well, where was I? Yeah, Lamb there. Wherever I was. Yes, 300,000 years, and Lamb's result. The geologist had already worked over old Kelvin on that question. You know, Kelvin said the age of the Earth can't be any more than about, at the most, 30 million years. 30 million years on the basis of the cooling. He assumed the Earth started out as a molten object. And he said on the basis of the rates of cooling, it can't be any older than about 30 million years. And they were mad as everything over that already. And radioactivity hadn't really come into the forefront, and they were trying to figure out what in the world to do with that value that Kelvin had gotten. They said later that radioactivity was the answer to the problem, and that Kelvin didn't take that into consideration. Well, that is a lot of foolishness. Kelvin didn't take it into consideration, but when you put radioactivity into the equations, a heat source in there, it doesn't change the value he got appreciably at all. Still amounts to about the same. And he assumed the Earth started out in a molten state, in a fluid state. And by fluid, I don't mean a cold fluid, one in which everything was melted, so to speak, at a tremendously high temperature, thousands of degrees. Well, I don't believe that at all. And that's a major factor in his calculation. You bring that down, you'll get a much smaller age for things. But anyhow, they were still mad over Kelvin. I'm wondering what in the world to do with him and his 30 million years, since things had to be up toward that billion-year mark, they figured, to get all this evolution that they wanted. And here comes Lamb now with 300,000 years, not even a half a million years. And what to do with him? Well, the thing to do is just pay no attention to him, because he's got too much of a reputation as a physicist. He's probably the greatest hydrodynamicist who ever lived. He wrote a book called Hydrodynamics. Reading the book, it's a great book, has a tremendous amount of material in it. You'd never know that water was involved, though, that water was a fluid or water was wet or anything like that, reading the book. But anyhow, he wrote probably the greatest book ever written on the subject, and he was too tough a fellow to take on in an argument. So the best thing to do is just pay no attention to him in the first place and let it go, and this is what they did. Well, a few years ago, Professor Barnes was reading Volume 2 of Mining Geophysics, published by the Society of Exploration Geophysicists. A fellow by the name of Jacobs up at the University of British Columbia made a slight reference to Lamb's work. He said Lamb got 300,000 years for the age of the Earth, and obviously this can't be right, because it's at least 4.5 billion years old. Lamb made some error somewhere. And, of course, the whole thing was dismissed then on that basis. Well, Professor Barnes wasn't satisfied with that, and so he decided to look into Lamb's work. So he went back and read the papers and decided to look at the problem himself then. His field being electricity and magnetism, he's very interested in it anyhow. So he took the data from 1835 down to 1965 and recalculated everything to see if there was really this decrease in the magnetic field that Lamb said was taking place,
And by the way, it doesn't take any brains to say it's happening, because all you have to do is look at the numbers. A blind man could see this decreasing practically, because there they are, the measurements. It didn't take any genius to decide whether some of the magnetic field's getting weaker. Look at the magnetometer. Every year it reads less than it read the year before. Even a fellow who's not a genius could say, well, it's decreasing. So it wasn't any question of whether it really was decreasing or not. It was obviously decreasing. But the important thing was the rate at which it was decreasing. Different people had remarked before then that it was decreasing. Chapman up at the University of Alaska says decreasing at a rate of about 5% per century, which is a very rapid decrease. The U.S. Geological Survey down in Menlo Park, they said that it's decreasing at such a fast rate that by about 3900 and a little more, 3900 A.D., there'll be no magnetic field. Everybody has agreed that it's decreasing, and that wasn't an argument, but it's the rate of decrease that's important. Professor Barnes plotted a graph of the data and then attempted to fit a mathematical curve to it to see the rate of decrease. He found, using the standard techniques of curve fitting, that the field would decrease with exponentially, similar to a radioactive mineral, at having a half-life of 1,400 years. In other words, the field loses one half of its value every 1,400 years. That's very rapid, isn't it? Every 1,400 years, it has only one half of what it started out with at the beginning of that 1,400 years. That's a tremendously rapid decrease in the field. All right, hold on to that. Well, no, we'll go on. I'll say more about that and then take up the other aspect of this problem. What he did then was to build an equation. Taking the magnetic field at the present time, the rate of decay of the magnetic field, and to calculate then back in time, measuring time backwards from today, to determine what the field would be if it continues to decrease at this rate, what it would be in times past. Well, he found that at 10,000 B.C., at 10,000 B.C., you would have a field that had about the strength of the magnetic field between the pole pieces of a modern radar set. And that's a tremendously large magnetic field in itself. He went back then to 1,000,000 B.C. Now, about 1,000,000 years ago, the field would be about 10 to the 215th power. That's a one followed by 215 zeros, that many Tesla. Now, Tesla is a large unit for measuring the strength of a magnetic field. That was a number, of course, if you added all the magnetic fields in the universe together and more, nobody'd even believe you'd get such a field as that. See, galaxies have magnetic fields, stars have magnetic fields, some planets do, the Earth, maybe Jupiter might have one. People are uncertain whether Jupiter really has one or not. But anyhow, if you put the whole thing together, nobody'd believe for the whole universe that you could get a magnetic field that size. But yet, on the basis of the decay of the field and its strength in the last, from 1835 to 1965, that's the way the field is changing, and that's what it would be in the past. Well, of course, you object and say, that's such a small time span. Maybe the field doesn't change that way. Well, maybe it doesn't. But the uniformitarian, how many years has he been studying the Earth? And how much data, what's his time span for studying the Earth, by the way? Well, if you go from Darwin, 1859, down to the present time, that's no more than the study of the magnetic field then. So how is one line of evidence so much superior when the geologists holding the uniformitarian position have really been in the saddle only a little more than 100 years, and their studies have extended only over 100 years? How come their quality of data is of so much a higher quality of data than the measurements with an instrument, and that instrument sits there, it couldn't care whether you were evolutionist or creationist, and just records values, and it doesn't make any difference what your philosophy is. But when a geologist gets out in the field and looks at a set of rocks, to quote a structural geologist at the University of California, Berkeley, he said, well, 70% of our observation is pure bias as to the position that we hold. Well, that magnetometer couldn't care if you were what you were. He couldn't care if you were a man from Mars. It just records whatever the magnetic field is and has nothing to do with your philosophy about things at all. I maintain that's a far superior quality of data myself. And that goes over more than 100 years. That goes from 1835, by the way, instead of 1859 down. Well, anyhow, regardless of what you want to argue, this is what the magnetic field is showing. And maybe it has changed different in the past. But on the basis of all the scientist can deal with, which is namely what he observes, and he has nothing other than that, the field is changing in this manner. Now, in the first place, Professor Barnes then says 10,000 B.C. gives you such a strong field. If you go back past that, you're going to get a field stronger than the magnetic field in magnetic stars. And I don't think any astronomer or any geophysicist would believe that a planet could have a field stronger than a magnetic star. Yes?
What exact effect does the field?
Well, it'll have a lot to do with the carbon-14. It'll have a lot to do with production of carbon-14. It'll have a lot to do with the mutation rate that's taking place here on the Earth.
I guess what are they having? They have a physical effect, a heating effect?
Oh, yes, that's what I'm coming to next, is the heating effect, which I think is very important, yes. Oops, I got to watch that time. About to forget here. Okay, I have about 10 minutes left, so let me go on. 10:45 is when I'm supposed to stop, I think, isn't it? Well, let me finish this story, and I'll quit at the end of it. Let's take a look at the cause of the magnetic field. Now, there is no way to say for sure what causes the magnetic field, you understand. Since the magnetic field is associated with the interior of the Earth, there's no way that a person can say, I know the field is caused by such and such agency. So what you have to do in finding out about the magnetic field is to propose a set of explanations and then try to eliminate those that won't fit the data. Since you can't observe it directly, this is about the only approach that you have. It's like trying to find out about what the interior structure of the Earth is. You propose certain models and then you try to eliminate them in the light of the data that you have. Well, different models have been proposed. The dynamo has been proposed, but it's a violation of the... Some have said the Earth has a self-maintaining dynamo operating in the core. But this is a violation of certain principles in electricity and magnetism and does not seem at all to be possible. Some have said, well, magnetic material is distributed throughout the Earth, and just pure magnetic material, like chunks of rock that have a certain magnetic susceptibility. This is the cause of the field. But yet there is not the concentration of it, at least in the crust of the Earth, which is the only thing we have to study directly, that could even remotely give you the size field that we have. Others have said the magnetic field is produced when charged particles hit the surface of the Earth and cause a magnetic field due to their residing on the surface rocks of the Earth. But this can't give you a strong enough field. The only thing that has escaped so far any fatal objections is the idea that there are currents traveling in the core of the Earth, in the fluid core of the Earth, and the Earth certainly seems to have a fluid core because shear waves will not travel through the core of the Earth, but longitudinal waves will. And again. All right, I'll just hold it here instead of taking the time to fool with it again. Fasten that thing on different the next time. Well, the only model that has escaped any really fatal objections is this of electrical currents traveling in the core. And most geophysicists and astronomers believe that this is the cause of the magnetic field. Now, it may not be, you understand. There may be something else. But at least everything they've been able to think of up to the present time, this seems to be the best explanation. By that I mean it has fewer objections to it and seems to fit, not have any really fatal objections associated with it. Now, that's not satisfactory, of course, but when you study in physics and astronomy, this is the approach that you must use sometimes, because unless you can get a Jules Verne trip down to the core of the Earth, you can't find out so much about the interior of it except indirectly. And until you really make a trip to places like the moon, well, you can't find out for sure a lot of things. Of course, when they landed on the moon, a lot of the theories really bit the dust, didn't they? What dust they could find, and so forth, there on the moon. Well, anyhow, if that is the cause of the magnetic field, then, and certainly a current you see traveling in a conductor or in a conducting body will have a magnetic field associated with it. If the field is decreasing, then that means those currents are slowing down, growing weaker and weaker and weaker in the core of the Earth. And the only way they would do that, of course, is for their energy, the energy associated with the current, to be dissipated in some form. Well, a current traveling in a resistor gives up its energy as heat energy. Isn't that right? When you turn on your electric stove to high and the coil gets red hot, of course, you're converting electrical energy into what? Heat energy there. A resistance is in that coil. And due to the resistance, you have your energy dissipated as heat energy. Well, if this is what is happening, and as I say, most believe this is actually what is happening, your field is growing weaker, the currents are dying out, this is why the field is growing weaker, their energy is being given up as heat energy, and when the field ceases, supposedly those currents have come to a stop. All of their energy has been given up into heat energy. Now then, the heat that would be produced by the currents depends directly on the square of the current. A heating effect at 20,000 BC, going back to 20,000 BC, the heating effect due to these currents would be so great that you would separate the core from the mantle, the core of the Earth from the mantle of the Earth. That would produce some serious problems on the surface of the Earth. Anybody's up here on the surface with the core separating from the mantle, you're in a real problem. What to hang on to? The heating effect associated with these currents that you would see the field, due to the field being so strong. For the field to be of a certain strength, you've got to have a current of a certain size. See, the current had to be stronger in the past than it is now. For the size current that would produce the field at 1,000,000 B.C., you would have such a heating effect that you would vaporize the Earth. Just be a bunch of atoms loose in space. You would actually vaporize the Earth. So, that's at 1,000,000 B.C., you're not going to have any Earth due to the heating. So the evolutionist who maintains the Earth is old is in a real dilemma of what to do with this magnetic field. Professor Barnes, in private conversation with me, and maybe he says this in this monograph, I don't recall, but in private conversation he says he thinks about 10,000 years ago is an upper limit to the age of the Earth. An upper limit now. That doesn't mean that's its age. That's an upper limit to its age on the basis of the decay of the magnetic field. Well, we'll stop right there for today. Which one? At 20,000 B.C. and at 1,000,000 B.C., you vaporize the Earth. The heating effect would be enough that it vaporized the Earth. Yes. The heating effect is directly proportional to the square of the current. Yeah. Okay, that's all for today.
Be shown to have been heavily developed in Eskimos, true work on it, and it has an influence on our bones. Skulls, actually, some skulls can be shown to have little crests, little ridges here, where the muscles, you see, are anchored. You trace them up there, and you find that this is a result of diet, you see. Do you understand what I'm saying? That these people who find Leakey, you have that out there in the National Geographic, when he finds these things, he says, it's a wonderful thing. It could be just a degenerate, inbred, diseased variant of a form that's just like you and me. Now try it on for size, is all I ask you. And ask other people why it couldn't it be a possible explanation, you see. Just like you heard Professor Slusher say, okay, you've got the canopy, but now there is also the impact idea. See? Be open. Don't lock yourself into one man's ideas. Don't become party people, says the scripture. Yes? Don't become party and get yourselves arguing among each other. Keep loose. Stay true in the big things. Stay true in the main important cardinal points of Christian life. And then be gentle. Remember what Paul says? Verse 15 in 2 Timothy 2:15, he says, study to be approved unto God, a workman rightly divided the word of truth. And then 24 and 25 and 26, he says, the servant of the Lord must not strive, be gentle, apt in patience, instructing those who oppose themselves. And you can do that with your Christian brothers and sisters too, by the way. Be patient. Don't say it's got to be the canopy theory. Don't say it's got to be the gaps theory. Don't even say theory in those two cases. That's what I would say, but I try not to pound there, notice? But open your mind and consider it, that these so-called ape men may be from tribes and races or varieties of men resulting from inbreeding and isolation. No true transition forms have been found between fossil apes and fossil man, And this is the kind of thing that I talk about in class. Because under the course title, Science, Beliefs, and Values, I am of the mind that a most practical, workable, and real world, life and death possession of the college freshman can be and is their worldview, their philosophy, what they think about origins, what they think about their fellow human beings. If they see their fellow human beings as only matter and motion, then isn't it reasonable that they can use their fellow human beings as means to their ends? That's precisely what the socialists and the communists do, you see. They don't care, the communists don't care how many people they kill, as long as their goal is achieved. Murder is accomplished and is approved. We can't do that, because every single lovely one is a creation of God, black, white, red, yellow, so forth. And we love them. We honor them. Respect them. Here are statements by students who have been in my classes explaining what they have experienced. I have also given them an assignment. I said, now you show me how you've discovered the use of evolution in your daily activity, whether it's a TV program, a radio program, your professor in social science. Don't tell me his name. I'm not trying to check on him. I merely want you to report to me how you have been able, by your ears and your eyes, to detect the use of evolutionary ideas. And I get papers back entitled, Everyday Evolution. Evolution in psychology, evolution in sociology, evolution in anthropology. It's amazing. They are surprised how much they have been bamboozled or, you know, badgered with unknowingly, not realizing. And it's a very useful lesson. See, in the fall, we talk about how do men conceive the universe and the place of the earth in it. And that's the origin of the universe I discuss. Then in the fall, winter, we talk about now where does life come from and how is the continuity of it maintained, reproduction and genetics, the origin of life. In the spring term, what's the origin of man? How is his culture related to the way he does what he does? The idea of evolution is brought in, full blown, and then, of course, the creation model as well. So that through the entire year, I'm talking about creation and God in the public tax-supported institution. Well, my wife says, don't keep on going. They won't remember the last things you said because they're getting so hungry anyway. But I don't want to forget to tell you, have you seen the book Naked Ape? Have you heard of the book The Naked Ape? It's required reading in many schools. Well, if you have, then would you also look for The Trousered Apes? It's the title of another book. And this is a neutralizer. This is an antithesis. This is the other side. Trousered Apes by Duncan Williams. Duncan Williams. Sick literature in a sick society. Sick literature in a sick society. Why are we sick, sick, sick? Because we're godless, godless, godless. Read Romans. It's all over again. And there you find, I think, a very interesting discourse. If you're a science teacher, I have some more of these. And, oh, I was going to give you this. Quick, like, somebody, would you take these up to the door there, and as people leave, would you give them a copy? There's a school board doing something that you might be encouraged to try. Trousered Ape is published by Arlington House. Arlington House. Thank you very much, Miss Heller. Folks, we've loved being here. We love you. And you come and ask a question if you want to personally. But you are ready to get something to eat because in an hour you want to start the test.
Do you have any more copies of the article Creation
and Expansion? No, I'm sorry, sir. But you find it in one of the recent issues of Bible Science Newsletter. Or if you know someone here, go up to the library and get a photographic copy. Is the only modus procedure I can suggest. Roy, how about your question?
I was going to ask, in some of these courses that you come out, if you removed evolution from it, how much would there be?
Very good, sir. Almost nothing. Well, if you want to give them, are you going to take the test? Well, then give them to me now, and I'll try to look it over. Are you going to stay for lunch or something like that? I'll look it over right now. But let's stand adjourned, and Godspeed to every one of you, please.